Scottish Qualifications Authority, National Qualifications 2013. English for speakers of other languages, higher. Section A, listening. Recording 1. Listen to the interview. Answer the questions which follow. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in Section A, Recording 1, before you hear the interview.
Richard Cohen spent 7 years travelling to 22 countries chasing the sun, and this is the title of his latest book. In the epic story of the star that gives us life, he turns his attention to all aspects of the sun, including our attitudes to it at different times and in different civilizations. From solar worship to solar power, what sort of attitudes to the sun do humans have?
Over the years in different cultures, we worship the sun, we fear it, and we think we can control it. Many societies have myths that if we don't worship the sun in the right way, it may not rise again next morning.
The solstice is the root of many rituals. Was there any such ritual that struck you?
I travelled to Peru, and in Cuzco there's a huge commercial overlay to the summer solstice celebrations, but they're still attached to the ancient rituals. A llama was offered up, though I'm happy to say it got away with its life. But you've got the whole town getting involved in dressing up as ancient Inca warriors and priests and so on.
Did you get the feeling they were taking this seriously? That it meant something beyond being fun or a touristy event?
They did pack in the tourists, but there seemed something genuine in the feeling they had. That the sun gave them life, organised their world.
Another magical element about the sun are eclipses. In 2003, you witnessed an eclipse in Antarctica. Can you tell us about that?
We were in the Russian base and were told that there had been a huge storm that had destroyed all the tents and that the plains were covered in snow. A larger storm was coming up behind it. Our Russian pilot flew us in between the two storms, and we had just that window to witness this extraordinary sight. It was surreal, with fluorescent blue around the edges, like something from a film set. This eclipse was close to the horizon. The sun and moon did a sort of dance together, and the moon seemed to be devouring it, just like in the ancient stories.
Thinking of us living in the modern world, we're more obsessed with the sun in a less spiritual way, in terms of trying to control it and using it for solutions to practical problems, particularly in terms of energy. You also look at that in your book, how we try to capture energy.
Yes, we get as much sun in 44 minutes in terms of the energy we get as the world uses in a whole year. And yet only about 2% of our energy needs are met by sun energy. I went to the largest desert in Western Europe, in southern Spain. The area of Almeria had gone from tremendous poverty and it had been turned round by the discovery of water and wells, but also the notion it would be the perfect place to set up solar energy. It's one of the most remarkable places in Europe for harnessing the sun and using it for commercial effect, as well as research and development.
That's all we've got time for. Many thanks to Richard Cohen. Next week I'll be talking to... Richard Cohen spent 7 years travelling to 22 countries chasing the sun, and this is the title of his latest book. In the epic story of the star that gives us life, he turns his attention to all aspects of the sun, including our attitudes to it at different times and in different civilizations. From solar worship to solar power, what sort of attitudes to the sun do humans have?
Over the years in different cultures, we worship the sun, we fear it, and we think we can control it. Many societies have myths that if we don't worship the sun in the right way, it may not rise again next morning.
The solstice is the root of many rituals. Was there any such ritual that struck you?
I travelled to Peru, and in Cuzco there's a huge commercial overlay to the summer solstice celebrations, but they're still attached to the ancient rituals. A llama was offered up, though I'm happy to say it got away with its life. But you've got the whole town getting involved in dressing up as ancient Inca warriors and priests and so on.
Did you get the feeling they were taking this seriously? That it meant something beyond being fun or a touristy event?
They did pack in the tourists, but there seemed something genuine in the feeling they had. That the sun gave them life, organised their world.
Another magical element about the sun are eclipses. In 2003, you witnessed an eclipse in Antarctica. Can you tell us about that?
We were in the Russian base and were told that there had been a huge storm that had destroyed all the tents and that the plains were covered in snow. A larger storm was coming up behind it. Our Russian pilot flew us in between the two storms, and we had just that window to witness this extraordinary sight. It was surreal, with fluorescent blue around the edges, like something from a film set. This eclipse was close to the horizon. The sun and moon did a sort of dance together, and the moon seemed to be devouring it, just like in the ancient stories.
Thinking of us living in the modern world, we're more obsessed with the sun in a less spiritual way, in terms of trying to control it and using it for solutions to practical problems, particularly in terms of energy. You also look at that in your book, how we try to capture energy.
Yes, we get as much sun in 44 minutes in terms of the energy we get as the world uses in a whole year. And yet only about 2% of our energy needs are met by sun energy. I went to the largest desert in Western Europe, in southern Spain. The area of Almería had gone from tremendous poverty and it had been turned round by the discovery of water and wells, but also the notion it would be the perfect place to set up solar energy. It's one of the most remarkable places in Europe for harnessing the sun and using it for commercial effect, as well as research and development.
That's all we've got time for. Many thanks to Richard Cohen. Next week I'll be talking to...
Recording 2. Listen to the talk. Answer the questions which follow. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in Section A, Recording 2, before you hear the talk.
The light was just peeking through the window when the phone rang. Confused, I'd stumbled from the bed and opened the curtains. Big buildings, lots of shouting, car horns. New York. There's only one person who would dare ring me so early. Mom? Good news, she said. Your sister had the baby. It's a girl. I tried to act surprised. The truth is, I was ready for the new arrival, in part because of my sister's posts on Facebook. For the past 2 weeks, I've been crisscrossing America, making a radio documentary on the history of social networking. My trip began in California, where a group set up a computerized bulletin board in a record store in 1973. Over a couple of weeks, I met a host of interesting characters. Hippies with houseboats, ambitious Harvard students, people barely out of their teens running startup companies backed by billionaires. Along the way, I'd been test-driving some of the very technology I was learning about, using social networking sites to arrange interviews, check the news, and keep in touch with people scattered all over the world. I dropped in on the company that's become synonymous with social networking. Facebook may have once looked like a passing fad, but nowadays people take it very seriously. It's easy to see why. Half a billion users, a blockbuster film, a superstar CEO. It's a business worth 30 billion pounds. The headquarters of this trendy internet company is currently housed in an old factory in Silicon Valley. None of Facebook's employees look much over the age of 30. Fueled by free fruit, strong coffee, and late-night ping pong, they think they're in the vanguard of a revolution, pushing forward an idea that will change the world. Standing in the middle of their headquarters, it's hard to think they're wrong. They don't talk about where they are now, or their recent success, or the bundles of cash they're making, more than 1 billion pounds last year. Instead, they talk relentlessly about what's next. Chris Cox is vice president of product. In other words, he's in charge of making cool new stuff for your Facebook page. Cox paints a picture where all sorts of everyday decisions are influenced by our friends. Say I want to go out and eat in New York, he says. Instead of reading reviews from strangers, I'd go and read what my friends in New York recommend the most. That's how we think things are going to evolve, but we're not there yet. Afterwards, I'm at the hotel, checking my email, when Time Magazine Person of the Year walks in, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. It's a journalist's dream. I'm beside the richest 20-something on the planet. I fumble with my microphone and camera, but he's through the door in a flash. Back in New York, and it's time to find a restaurant for breakfast. Social networking isn't going to help us here. Instead, just ask a local. Right around the corner, the Morning Star Cafe. Tasty pancakes, hot coffee. I use my phone to glance at my Facebook page. Status updates from my sister. Baby is here, born at 2:03 a.m., perfectly healthy. The comments are pouring in. You and 16 other people like this. For me, one last flight to see my new niece. Just born, but already making an appearance on the computer screens of friends and family around the world. All this online communication is great, but it's still no substitute for actually being there. The light was just peeking through the window when the phone rang. Confused, I stumbled from the bed and opened the curtains. Big buildings, lots of shouting, car horns. New York. There's only one person who would dare ring me so early. Mom? Good news, she said. Your sister had the baby. It's a girl. I tried to act surprised. The truth is, I was ready for the new arrival, in part because of my sister's posts on Facebook. For the past 2 weeks, I've been crisscrossing America, making a radio documentary on the history of social networking. My trip began in California, where a group set up a computerized bulletin board in a record store in 1973. Over a couple of weeks, I met a host of interesting characters, hippies with houseboats, ambitious Harvard students, people barely out of their teens running startup companies backed by billionaires. Along the way, I'd been test-driving some of the very technology I was learning about, using social networking sites to arrange interviews, check the news, and keep in touch with people scattered all over the world. I dropped in on the company that's become synonymous with social networking. Facebook may have once looked like a passing fad, but nowadays people take it very seriously. It's easy to see why. half a billion users, a blockbuster film, a superstar CEO. It's a business worth 30 billion pounds. The headquarters of this trendy internet company is currently housed in an old factory in Silicon Valley. None of Facebook's employees look much over the age of 30. Fueled by free fruit, strong coffee, and late-night ping-pong, they think they're in the vanguard of a revolution, pushing forward an idea that will change the world. Standing in the middle of their headquarters, it's hard to think they're wrong. They don't talk about where they are now, or their recent success, or the bundles of cash they're making, more than 1 billion pounds last year. Instead, they talk relentlessly about what's next. Chris Cox is vice president of product. In other words, he's in charge of making cool new stuff for your Facebook page. Cox paints a picture where all sorts of everyday decisions are influenced by our friends. Say I want to go out and eat in New York, he says. Instead of reading reviews from strangers, I'd go and read what my friends in New York recommend the most. That's how we think things are going to evolve, but we're not there yet. Afterwards, I'm at the hotel, checking my email, when Time Magazine Person of the Year walks in, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. It's a journalist's dream. I'm beside the richest 20-something on the planet. I fumble with my microphone and camera, but he's through the door in a flash. Back in New York, and it's time to find a restaurant for breakfast. Social networking isn't going to help us here. Instead, just ask a local. Right around the corner, the Morning Star Cafe. Tasty pancakes, hot coffee. I use my phone to glance at my Facebook page. Status updates from my sister. Baby is here, born at 2:03 a.m., perfectly healthy. The comments are pouring in. You and 16 other people like this. For me, one last flight to see my new niece. Just born, but already making an appearance on the computer screens of friends and family around the world. All this online communication is great, but it's still no substitute for actually being there.
Recording 3. Listen to the discussion between Peter the interviewer, Andrew and Katie. Answer the questions which follow. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in Section A, Recording 3, before you hear the discussion.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health Watch at 1. Today, we're discussing the potential dangers of sunbeds and how they may be contributing to an increase in skin cancer. In the studio, we have a spokesperson from the Chartered Institute of Environmental Health, Andrew, and Katie from the UK Sunbed Association. Welcome.
Hi, Peter.
Hi, Peter.
First of all, Andrew, is the belief that a suntan is healthy nothing more than a myth? And what evidence, if any, do you have that the use of sunbeds is contributing to the rise in skin cancer?
Okay. Let me begin by saying that over time, the effects of too much UVA exposure can lead to a wide range of medical problems. Eye damage, immune system changes, cataracts, wrinkles, premature aging of skin, and of course, most worryingly of all, skin cancers. Skin cancer is in fact the most common form of cancer, and approximately 90% of all skin cancers can be traced to UV exposure. However, even though the dangers of sunbeds are well documented in terms of the negative effects they have on health, many users alarmingly continue to ignore advice.
But how can you say that sunbeds are responsible for skin cancer, rather than it being caused by people sunbathing carelessly, for example, when they are abroad on holiday?
Can I just say, this discussion seems to be focusing on the negative aspects of sunbeds and suntanning. Indoor tanning facilities do, in fact, represent a viable alternative to natural sunshine for stimulating the production of vitamin D. Admittedly, it's important to remember to take the same precautions that you would if you were in natural sunlight. Take the UK, for example. Levels of sunshine are low, and as a result, the body has less chance of manufacturing vitamin D, which plays an essential role in keeping bones, teeth and skin healthy.
Sorry, Katie, but yes, it is indeed difficult to prove the sunbeds are dangerous, as people don't only use sunbeds and then never go out in the sun. But despite this, a lot is still known about sunbeds and the negative effects they can have. Users get a mix of UV rays, and half an hour on a sunbed will give them far more exposure than spending the same amount of time in the sun. But very few sunbed users seem to be aware of this. They give little consideration to how intense sunbed rays are, and how potentially dangerous they are. Sunbeds are classified at the same carcinogenic level as tobacco, with the intensity of UV rays from sunbeds being up to 10 to 15 times higher than the midday sun. Younger people are especially at risk, and sunbed users under the age of 35 have a 75% higher risk of developing melanoma, the deadliest type of skin cancer.
Katie, do you go along with the belief held by the Institute that sunbeds do, in fact, increase the risks of skin cancer?
Absolutely not. Let us be clear that there is absolutely no evidence to suggest that the responsible use of sunbeds alone contributes to health concerns, including skin cancers. Obviously, there are some people who should stay away from sunbeds, but for the majority of people, they are a safe method of getting a tan and feeling good. We have always been clear that certain groups of people should never use sunbeds. However, the majority of people can tan, and the Sunbed Association offers advice to ensure customers are tanning safely.
Sorry, but I really have to disagree and add that skin cancer has become the third most common cancer in under 40s, which, according to research, is the age group which predominantly uses sunbeds. Another worry is that there appears to be a lack of enforcement of established regulations regarding the ages of sunbed users. The simple truth at the end of the day is that a suntan fades, but skin damage from tanning does not.
I'm sorry, but what you say is simply not factual. We work to ensure that the guidelines, with regard to the age of users, are followed, and...
Okay, we must leave it there, but thanks to you both. You can get further information regarding the use of sunbeds and their potential dangers from the British Medical Council website, which you will find at www... Good afternoon and welcome to Health Watch at 1. Today, we're discussing the potential dangers of sunbeds and how they may be contributing to an increase in skin cancer. In the studio, we have a spokesperson from the Chartered Institute of Environmental Health, Andrew, and Katie from the UK Sunbed Association. Welcome.
Hi, Peter.
Hi, Peter.
First of all, Andrew, is the belief that a suntan is healthy nothing more than a myth? And what evidence, if any, do you have that the use of sunbeds is contributing to the rise in skin cancer?
Okay, let me begin by saying that over time, the effects of too much UVA exposure can lead to a wide range of medical problems. Eye damage, immune system changes, cataracts, wrinkles, premature aging of skin, and of course, most worryingly of all, skin cancers. Skin cancer is in fact the most common form of cancer, and approximately 90% of all skin cancers can be traced to UV exposure. However, even though the dangers of sunbeds are well documented in terms of the negative effects they have on health, many users alarmingly continue to ignore advice.
But how can you say that sunbeds are responsible for skin cancer, rather than it being caused by people sunbathing carelessly, for example, when they are abroad on holiday?
Can I just say, this discussion seems to be focusing on the negative aspects of sunbeds and suntanning. Indoor tanning facilities do, in fact, represent a viable alternative to natural sunshine for stimulating the production of vitamin D. Admittedly, it's important to remember to take the same precautions that you would if you were in natural sunlight. Take the UK, for example. Levels of sunshine are low, and as a result, the body has less chance of manufacturing vitamin D, which plays an essential role in keeping bones, teeth and skin healthy.
Sorry, Katie, but yes, it is indeed difficult to prove that sunbeds are dangerous, as people don't only use sunbeds and then never go out in the sun. But despite this, a lot is still known about sunbeds and the negative effects they can have. Users get a mix of UV rays, and half an hour on a sunbed will give them far more exposure than spending the same amount of time in the sun. But very few sunbed users seem to be aware of this. They give little consideration to how intense sunbed rays are, and how potentially dangerous they are. Sunbeds are classified at the same carcinogenic level as tobacco, with the intensity of UV rays from sunbeds being up to 10 to 15 times higher than the midday sun. Younger people are especially at risk, and sunbed users under the age of 35 have a 75% higher risk of developing melanoma, the deadliest type of skin cancer.
Katie, do you go along with the belief held by the Institute that sunbeds do, in fact, increase the risks of skin cancer?
Absolutely not. Let us be clear that there is absolutely no evidence to suggest that the responsible use of sunbeds alone contributes to health concerns, including skin cancers. Obviously, there are some people who should stay away from sunbeds, but for the majority of people, they are a safe method of getting a tan and feeling good. We have always been clear that certain groups of people should never use sunbeds. However, the majority of people can tan, and the Sunbed Association offers advice to ensure customers are tanning safely.
Sorry, but I really have to disagree and add that skin cancer has become the third most common cancer in under 40s, which, according to research, is the age group which predominantly uses sunbeds. Another worry is that there appears to be a lack of enforcement of established regulations regarding the ages of sunbed users. The simple truth at the end of the day is that a suntan fades, but skin damage from tanning does not.
I'm sorry, but what you say is simply not factual. We work to ensure that the guidelines, with regard to the age of users, are followed, and...
Okay, we must leave it there, but thanks to you both. You can get further information regarding the use of sunbeds and their potential dangers from the British Medical Council website, which you will find at www...
You now have 1 minute to check your answers. This is the end of the listening test.